Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
He approves her message. Nikki Haley suspends her campaign but stops short of endorsing Donald Trump. One of her fundraisers tells us it will take a lot for the former president to get his vote.
Pressure change. New reports suggest the U.S. is pushing Ariel Henry to step down as Prime Minister of Haiti. A former diplomat says that is yet another example of the international community's catastrophic handling of the catastrophe there.
Changing course, Canada is set to resume funding for UNRWA, the main relief agency for Palestinians, after a new report addresses Israel's allegations against some of the agency's workers.
Remains to be seen, too. Nondescript storage containers outside a St. John's hospital are holding dozens of unclaimed bodies because their families can't afford to bury them.
Of sound mind, when it came to audio, the late inventor and engineer Bob Heil was all ears, which is why his creations reinvented concert sound and helped Peter Frampton score his biggest hit.
And what flappens in Vegas? Partiers on the Strip got a rare glimpse of a yellow-billed loon when the northern bird somehow flew far south and parked itself in the fountain of the Bellagio Hotel. As it happens, the Wednesday edition. Radio that knows in Vegas, you win some and you loon some. Well, she won Vermont, but because that was the only state she won, Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley has finally thrown in the towel.
In all likelihood, Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee when our party convention meets in July. I congratulate him and wish him well. I wish anyone well who would be America's president. Our country is too precious to let our differences divide us. I have always been a conservative Republican and always supported the Republican nominee. But on this question, as she did on so many others, Margaret Thatcher provided some good advice when she said, quote, never just follow the crowd. Always make up your own mind. It is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond it who did not support him. And I hope he does that.
Donald Trump now has a lock on the Republican nomination after a Super Tuesday that saw him win primary victories in more than a dozen states. It remains to be seen how many diehard Haley supporters will be willing to cast their votes for Mr. Trump in the general election. Ozzie Palomo is a lobbyist and fundraiser for Nikki Haley's campaign. We reached him in Fairfield, Connecticut.
Ozzie, we heard what Nikki Haley said publicly as she suspended her campaign, but you have just gotten off a phone call with Nikki Haley and her team. What can you tell us about what she said?
Yeah, I mean, it was a short, quick call thanking everyone for their support over the campaign. It was a good reminder of when this started a little over a year ago. She was polling in the single digits and I managed to outlast several top quality candidates and ultimately fell short following Super Tuesday, which was the marker she had previously set for her campaign.
Were you disappointed?
Yeah, I mean, look, anytime you back someone for office, you hope they win. Mm-hmm. Disappointment, I wouldn't necessarily call it a major disappointment. I think to the point I made earlier, you know, she stuck to kind of, you know, tough with her values and her Republican kind of ethos. And I think there's a lot to come of that going forward.
She was very careful with her language today, intentional, I'm sure. She did not endorse Donald Trump. She also said it's time for Donald Trump to do the choosing. So I want to dig into those words a little bit. She's worked for Donald Trump. There was lots of words exchanged to this point in this campaign, obviously. Do you think there's still a lot of bad blood there?
Yeah, look, I think she has a track record of doing things very kind of smart and calculative and certainly with poise and dignity. And I think her speech was just that. I think she left the door open for an endorsement. I think she also gave, you know, President Trump the opening to kind of come and solicit the support of a lot of her supporters going forward, which is a voting bloc he's going to need in order to be successful. I think right now, obviously, in the heat of a primary, a lot of things are said and a lot of people have feelings that tend to go by the wayside once it becomes a binary choice. And I think moving forward, I think the onus is on President Trump to run a clean kind of general election strategy that allows and attracts more people to come over to the Republican side and be successful in November.
What would Donald Trump have to say and do, in your view, to bring you on side, but also bring the other voters you talked about?
Yeah, and I think Nikki Haley touched on this during her speech. You know, she focused a lot on kind of core traditional Republican principles. That's, you know, strength on national security, you know, a limited government, a strong fiscal kind of conservative approach to the economy and outright governing. And I think those are things that, you know, when Donald Trump was president, touched on them as well. And the campaign, his rhetoric has been a little bit off from what his track record as president of the United States showed. So I think particularly from a national security perspective, you know, words have consequences and we're dealing with a bunch of hot issues around the globe. And I would like to see him come back to a more traditional, you know, pro-security approach to governance.
He hasn't shown a track record for that kind of behavior that you're saying you would like to hear and see. Of course, this is a former president who also spent months denying the outcome of the 2020 election. He's facing 91 felony charges and hundreds of billions of dollars in court judgments. So how do you weigh all of that? How do you consider supporting a candidate with the track record he has had?
Yeah, it's tough to do. There's no doubt about it. But I think, again, you have to somewhat bifurcate the two between what the campaign is doing. And I think they're doing a pretty good job. He's got a far more formal and structured team than he did back in 16 and certainly in 20. But then oftentimes the personality aspect kicks, which detracts from what the campaign strategy is, to your point. But if you look at it, me personally speaking, he doesn't have a track record of success of the 4 years that he was in office. We did have, you know, economic growth. We had the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. There's lots of positive things to point to. The issue at hand is oftentimes the noise is hard to cut through when he does kind of pull a lot of his antics.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying about things that you saw as positives. But when we talk about January 6th and denying the outcome of the 2020 election, whoever his team is, Donald Trump has shown who he is repeatedly. You know, are you worried that will only intensify if he were to get another mandate?
Look, there's no doubt that there's plenty of issues and baggage there to point to. You referenced the 91 counts. Those are going to linger over the election and the campaign over the next several months, certainly as the Supreme Court takes up the immunity case on April 25th, and then it goes on and on from there. But again, it becomes a binary choice, and I think you have to give him the opportunity to make a pivot to a general election strategy and keep an open mind if your ultimate end goal is to have Republicans be successful.
Is there anything the Democrats, the Joe Biden campaign, could say or do as you weigh what to do personally? Is there anything they could say or do to bring you on side, even if that wasn't your first choice?
Look, I think it's hard to, you know, if you want to talk about track records, I think there's plenty of holes to poke in what the Biden administration either has done or lacked to do, particularly in and around the border and a lot of other issues that I fundamentally just have a disagreement with. Mm-hmm. But again, things are certainly fluid. And I think if we were to have some sort of national crises or something where Biden would step in and be a lot more forthcoming and presidential than he has been, perhaps. But I think, you know, I'm a Republican through and through. And I think I'm inclined to support the candidate. I think if the candidate going forward, you know, shows some sort of kind of core principles that I can agree with. And again, I'm willing to give it an open shot here as we pivot to a general election strategy.
What about 2028? Do you see her? I mean, I know that's an eternity in politics, certainly, that we're talking about. But do you see her coming back?
I think she's going to be a viable candidate. She's 51 years old. She's young. She's got the, you know, kind of the rest of her life ahead of her. And she certainly has, whether, you know, purposely or inadvertently, walked into this kind of center right movement of folks that would like to, you know, the Republican Party to come back to where it has been traditionally and ultimately be able to be in a good position should she choose to run, you know, down the road.
Thanks for this, Ozzie.
No problem. Thank you.
Ozzie Palomo was a fundraiser for Nikki Haley's presidential campaign. We reached him in Fairfield, Connecticut. Canada is set to resume funding the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. The report comes from a senior government official whom the CBC has agreed not to name. It's a reversal of the Fed's decision to pause funding to UNRWA after Israel alleged that 12 of the agency's employees were involved in the Hamas attacks of October 7th. Investigations into those claims are ongoing, but Chris Gunna says restoring funding now is the right thing to do. He's the former director of strategic communications at UNRWA. We reached him in London, England.
Chris, assuming this does become official, what do you think Canada has seen that made it decide to change course?
It's very difficult to say because the evidence which the Israelis have alleged this these allegations over has not been produced. And I imagine that the Canadians, who, by the way, have been a very, very good donor to UNRWA, have probably seen the European decision, which came out last Thursday. And what the Europeans said is that they have seen the interim report by the Office of Internal Oversight of the United Nations, and that that interim report has found no evidence at all against these UNRWA staff members. And I think it may well be that the Canadian government has seen what the Europeans have done and realised that there is a strong case, given the starvation that's breaking out across the Gaza Strip, to refund UNRWA.
Our colleague Catherine Cullen, and host of The House, was the one who broke this story, and people can see more about it on our website. She says that a government source told CBC News Canada also received a copy of that interim internal report from the United Nations as well. But as we said, this was an interim report. There's going to be a full report from the UN, of course, and a separate independent review that's being done by the French Foreign Minister, Catherine Colonna. Why not wait for those final reports?
Because there is widespread starvation. Children, as you and I speak, Neil, are dying of malnutrition in northern Gaza. I speak regularly to people in Rafah, in southern Gaza. Their children are going to bed screaming at night because they're hungry. They wake up in the morning screaming because they're hungry. Starvation is a slow motion massacre, and that massacre has begun.
We've had several conversations just in the last few days about the efficacy or lack thereof of the aerial aid drops, but also, you know, young children putting flour in their pockets and starving, as you said, and the concerns. But we've also heard aid workers in our conversations and officials say Israel is not allowing enough aid to get into Gaza. So is funding really the problem here at this point?
It's both. I mean, the Israelis can't block aid if the aid hasn't been bought and it doesn't exist. So, yes, there has to be the proper funding. At the same time, the aid convoys have got to go in. And to be clear, the only agency with the experience, the capacity, is UNRWA.
In January, Chris, we spoke with Canada's former deputy representative to the United Nations, Louise Blais, about the allegations that had just come out at that time and Canada's decision to pause funding. Here's a bit of what she told us at that time.
I think you want to send a very clear message to the UN leadership to say how seriously we're taking these allegations, how alarmed we are, and how much we want to make sure that the funding that Canadians are providing does not get in the hands of terrorists. I think these are legitimate requests, and I think without actually doing a suspension, I'm not sure it would have as much of an impact on the leadership.
What do you say, Chris, to Louise Blais and others who argued that a suspension, a temporary one, was necessary at the time to try to restore faith in this UN agency?
I would like to point this straight back at Ms. Blais and say, what have you seen? What did Israel present to you that made you so clear that it was worth taking the risk of people starving to death? Wouldn't it have been much better to demand the evidence and to say there has to be due process? The UN had made it clear that it would investigate. There's now an internal investigation, an external investigation. I would say that the risk of neutrality violations and Canadian taxpayers' money ending up in the wrong hands, that those risks are outweighed significantly by the fact that innocent women and children are dying as a result of those sorts of decisions which donors have taken.
Canada's Conservative opposition leader, Pierre Poilievre, in the aftermath of these allegations, called UNRWA, quote, a terrorist organization, unquote, his words. He says if he were elected prime minister, he would slash its funding. You know, when we're talking about UNRWA's credibility in the eyes of the Canadian public, Was it not necessary to do this to make sure that people understood that Canada was taking these allegations seriously and that it would look at any reporting to see how to proceed in the future? What choice did Canada have?
I mean, I would like to ask about the political credibility of Mr. Polyev if he's making unsubstantiated, extraordinary allegations that a neutral UN humanitarian organization that runs classes for 550,000 children in over 700 schools across the Middle East, I'd like to take him to some of the UNRWA schools to show them the democratic school parliaments in parts of the Middle East where democracy is, you know, is hardly respected. UNRWA, through its education system, is providing an escape from the poverty trap to a life of dignity and prosperity. These children in our schools are becoming global citizens. That's the kind of thing that UNRWA does. Its work is utterly transformative across the Middle East.
What kind of vetting process does UNRWA have in place for its staff?
Well,
from your
well,
experience, just let people know.
Yes. One of the most interesting is that UNRWA gives the names digitally of all of its 33,000 staff to all of the host governments. So Israel was given the list of all of UNRWA staff members in Gaza and the West Bank. And guess what? It was only the night after the International Court of Justice issued its provisional rulings against Israel in the genocide case brought by South Africa that these allegations appeared on the front page of the New York Times. You can read into that what you like, but UNRWA has always investigated all of these allegations, and we take disciplinary action up to and including dismissal.
As we've said, Canada appears at this point set to reverse its position on this before its next payment to UNRWA was actually scheduled in April. So that $25 million will now go through on time next month. In the end, was Canada's suspension specifically really that damaging?
It was damaging politically. Make no mistake about it, because the Canadian abandonment of UNRWA was part of a domino effect. So there was a choice that Canada made. It was a political choice. And I'd like to think that that can be put behind us and that Canadian taxpayers will rest comfortably in the knowledge that their taxpayers' money are being given to an agency which has a very proud track record in delivering humanitarian aid in the most appalling circumstances like you have today in Gaza, and to the satisfaction of all the major donors.
Chris, I thank you for your time.
It's a real pleasure, Neil. Thank you for having me on the program.
Chris Gunness is the former Director of Strategic Communications at UNRWA. We reached him in London, England. When you go to Vegas, you expect certain things. Casinos, obviously, bright lights, flashy shows, Elvis impersonators. You don't expect this. That is the sound of a yellow-billed loon, a bird that lives in the far north and rarely strays south of Canada, and yet strayed so far south of Canada that it wound up in the fountain of the Bellagio Hotel in Las Vegas. Kurt Bizard is a bird expert at the nearby Henderson Bird Viewing Preserve. We reached him in Henderson, Nevada.
Kurt, how in the world did this bird end up in Las Vegas in the Bellagio Fountain?
Well, we're not sure. Las Vegas is on the Pacific Flyway. Mm-hmm. So a surprising number of birds come through Las Vegas that are unusual for the desert environment. We see a lot of heron. We see a lot of cormorants and pelicans and seagulls that you wouldn't expect to find in the middle of the desert. But the Henderson Bird Viewing Preserve is a series of nine large ponds. And as the birds fly in, they often will either land in Lake Mead or they'll land at the Bird Viewing Preserve. And we see a lot of birds there.
But this little loon got a little confused. It got a little bit lost. So how, you know, because you had seen it a few days before elsewhere, right? Before it showed up at the Bellagio?
Yes. It showed up at the Bird Preserve on February 26th. And then the day afterwards, it showed up at the Bellagio. And this is a pretty rare bird. There's less than 10,000 of them in the world. And it really, it breeds in the Arctic Circle and is mostly seen in Alaska. Very rarely does it ever get to the lower 48. And every time it does, there are crowds of bird watchers wanting to see it because it's such a rare bird. But to see it in Las Vegas, we think maybe there was a storm. You know, we have had a number of large storms recently that blew it off course and it ended up here.
It was, well, maybe it just likes the good life, Kurt. Maybe.
Yeah, maybe you wanted to go gambling. You never know.
The other thing that surprised us about this story as we were talking about it this morning is that, while I recognize you have a nature preserve and there are clearly bird watchers like you out there, the fact that the Bellagio went along with this, shut things down, tweeted about it, joked about it, saying, you know, we have the most exclusive of guests with us. Were you surprised that they took that extra step?
I was and wasn't. Las Vegas is a place where unusual things happen. And when something unusual happens, you know, people usually will take advantage of it. And I think also it was very kind of the Bellagio to close down the fountains because it would have frightened the bird. And the problem is he hasn't eaten, so we really don't have any fish at the Henderson Bird Preserve, just small minnows, and there are no fish where he's at. And so the poor thing really didn't have anything to eat. And so if he would have been frightened away, I don't know what might have become of him.
What has happened to him now?
This morning he was captured by the Fish and Wildlife. And they're going to feed him and probably take him someplace safer to release him, probably on the ocean. Or maybe he'll fly back to Canada, you know, and tell you about his gambling adventure.
Always welcome he is. Have you and your fellow bird watchers or the officials who've taken him in, have they named him?
Not that I'm aware of, but I wouldn't be surprised. He's been big news for the last week. You know, the Bellagio fountains are a beautiful thing. Yeah. At night, they have lights and so on. They have almost as many visitors coming to see him as they did having coming to see the fountains. So he's a big draw.
How was he reacting to all that attention?
He was just sort of swimming. There's a lower part and then an upper part. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of hiding in the back part underneath some overhanging stuff. I think the problem is he got there. There are so many lights, there are so many skyscrapers, and it was intimidating to him, and he just sort of hunkered down.
Are you worried? You know, I know you said this has been happening. We've talked about, too, I believe we have spoke about flamingos, you know, storms, rerouting these birds. Are you worried that that's happening with a little more frequency?
I think that climate change has resulted not just in climate warming, but as you in Canada know, very unusual things. And the birds are confused and not sure where to go.
I know you don't want them to go off course and be lost, of course, but are there's some other rare birds you'd like to have a glimpse at?
Yeah, we're always excited. Normally we'll see one or two rare birds a year. But the last year, we saw maybe 5 or 10 unusual birds. Mm-hmm. We saw a groove-billed anee from the Caribbean. We saw a rufous-back robin that normally is in central Mexico and now lives here.
Is it true that you also saw another Canadian bird, a duck?
Yes, I saw a long-tailed duck, also breeds in the Arctic. Not quite as endangered as the yellow-billed loon, but this duck is also in Lake Mead and probably got thrown off course by the very same thing that threw the loon off. That duck isn't as famous because he didn't end up at the Bellagio, but it's the same principle.
Well, yeah. Glad we can give him some notoriety through this conversation as well. I hope they're both okay. Kurt, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Kurt Bizard works at the Henderson Bird Viewing Preserve, not far from Las Vegas. He was in Henderson, Nevada. And the Nevada Department of Wildlife tells us that yellow-billed loon in the fountain is in good health and has been relocated. You can find that story along with some photos on our website, cbc.ca/AIH.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Over the past few months, calls for the resignation of Haiti's prime minister have been growing louder, and now another voice has apparently joined that chorus, the United States government. As we told you earlier this week, Haiti has been under a state of emergency and evening curfew after gangs attacked two of the country's prisons, freeing thousands of inmates. Gang leaders have said that if Ariel Henry remains in power, the country could face a civil war. Since those attacks, Mr. Henry has been silent and absent. And then, yesterday, he unexpectedly arrived in Puerto Rico after a failed attempt to return to Haiti. According to the Miami Herald, during that flight, Mr. Henry received a message from the U.S. State Department asking him to agree to a new transitional government and to resign as prime minister. Daniel Foote is the former U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti. We reached him in Buffalo, New York.
Ambassador Foote, would you say Ariel Henry's days as prime minister are numbered?
I certainly hope so, for everyone involved, including Ariel Henry. The Haitian people, what you've seen in the last week is not protest. This is a revolution at this point in time. It's not just against Ariel Henry. It's against the international community, the U.S. and Canada, and everybody telling the Haitian people what to do and making it worse every time. So this is kind of about Haitian sovereignty. Henry is still trying to go back to Haiti. And if he gets to Haiti, they're going to kill him. I hate to be so blunt, but they are. He's done nothing in 2.5 years for the population, but let it get worse. But he has a huge incentive to remain as prime minister, because he's a suspect in the assassination of the previous president, Jovenel Moise.
But can you imagine him actually being able to return to Haiti at this point? It's interesting that he left at all.
With foreign assistance, kind of like how we did with Aristide in 1994 when we took the U.S. military and imposed him back. I don't think he can fly back in there. I mean, it seems clear to everybody but U.S. policymakers right now that he can't fly back there.
International pressure, though, is what's happening right now. The U.S. talking to him, others as well, trying to work out a plan for some sort of resignation. But isn't that a version of the same old that we've Absolutely. Spoken about, that others have said, that, you know, we spoke to one Haitian politician who said, you know, what would help is if countries like the United States and Canada stopped picking the winners and losers. So on one hand, there needs to be a change, clearly, for the people of Haiti. On the other hand, when the pressure is coming from the outside again, doesn't that just take things back to where they've always been?
Well, where the U.S. and Canada are trying to go, I believe, is exactly the same story another time, and it will have the same outcome. They want Ariel Henry to form a transition government. He's not in charge of Haiti. He never was. And we've ignored for 2.5 years this horrendous situation in Haiti and just said, oh, Ariel's got it under control. He's in charge. He's our guy. He's our partner. Well, he failed miserably, and the situation has gotten completely out of control. And if the U.S. thinks that they're going to install, or Canada, install a partner in Haiti with which they can work, they can do that. But it'll fail, and it won't get better. What the international community needs to do is sit back, put its hands in its pockets for 8 weeks, because in that time, there's no way an international security mission can get there logistics-wise, just too quick, and empower the Haitians to come to a consensus political agreement over a provisional government and over a roadmap towards restoring security, engaging with the international community, and eventually moving towards elections. If the international community do not give the space to the Haitian people, the situation in Haiti will just continue to deteriorate. We've seen it throughout history.
Yeah. What would that giving space, but also empowering them to bring in a provisional government, what would that look like and sound like?
In the short term, I think it is talking to the folks who had a political consensus 2 years ago, the Montana Group, and other civil society and political opposition. The U.S. hasn't talked to these people in 2.5 years. They thought that their guy Henri was just going to fix it all, and he has avoided fixing it so he can stay in power, so he can avoid justice for the assassination.
We talked about that plan, all set to go, with Monique Kleska, who was one of the people who put the Montana Accord together. She was understandably frustrated as she watched things unfold and deteriorate in Haiti. I mean, it's a complete collapse. Given how bad the current situation is, how do you imagine the country might actually go about addressing these issues?
It has been really bad for 2.5 years, but now all of a sudden they let 4,000 prisoners out and the internationals are up in arms. Oh my God, it's terrible. We have to do something. We should have done something 2.5 years ago. And empowered them in the right way. We didn't, and we're here because of the fault of Canada and the United States right now. And if they do the same thing, they're going to have the same result. They need to trust the Haitian people. And if Trudeau and Biden don't give them the opportunity to find their own political solution, they will continue to fail.
Do you sense a shift, given the fact that so many people have said, inside and outside of Haiti,
I think they're realizing that the jig is up, that they failed, that it was stupid, as I told them that it was at the time. And now they're just trying to do damage control. But the U.S. always insists that it needs a partner in the country. It's not the U.S.'s country, right? So let the Haitians get together and tell us who the partner is, and then there will be a semi-trustworthy partner that sort of speaks for the Haitian people with whom we can work. So my advice is patience. Do not rush to failure. And I'm confident that the Haitians will reach a political agreement within 8 weeks.
You think they'll reach a political agreement within 8 weeks?
I do, yes. They had one 2 years ago, and I believe that they can reconstitute it.
Ambassador Foote, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Daniel Foote is the former U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti. We reached him in Buffalo, New York. They're freezer containers like you might see on the back of a truck or behind a building and never think twice about. But the containers outside St. John's Newfoundland's Health Science Center piqued the interest of CBC journalist Anthony Germain, who discovered that they contain dozens of bodies because there's no more space inside the hospital to keep the dead. And there's one main reason the bodies are unclaimed: money. We reached Anthony Germain in St. John's.
Anthony, how did you first hear about these containers?
You know, you're in the business, so you know, you get a tip and someone tells you, you know, those freezer trucks that you see parked next to the kids' hospital, well, they don't want you to know this, but they're filled with dead people. And I was thinking, okay, that's one of those tips that sounds so absurd that you start thinking about it and you go, that's probably true. So you do what you can to confirm it and managed to sort of get a sense of what the situation was in the main morgue here in St. John's and learned that there were bodies stacked on stretchers inside the morgue, sometimes two per stretcher, sometimes three per stretcher, and they were actually in the halls, and that they basically had to construct some kind of overflow for the number of bodies that they had.
And were those containers actually mitigating the issue of two bodies on a stretcher, as you said, or is that in addition to what was in that?
Well, I think from what I can tell so far, the idea was, you know, we'll put a freezer container there and then that'll offset some of the pressure on the morgue. But as more people die and as more people decide they don't want to claim the bodies, they found themselves in a problem. So, for instance, when I started the story really last week, there were three containers, and within the last 48 hours, they start using a fourth one, and there's a fifth one there just, you know, on standby in case.
Well, there's a couple of things to dig into there, but one, is it that more people are dying there? Is that part of the problem?
Well, the death rate, you know, we have Canada's oldest province, so it's an aging population. So percentage-wise, there, you know, about 5,500 people die here every year, and that mortality rate is increasing. So yes, on the one hand, more people are dying, but the real problem is not so much that, but that more and more people are being told when someone dies, either in the hospital or at home, okay, we have the body, here's the death certificate, now it's up to you to claim the body. And then they do the math and they say, okay, well, cremation's $3,000, a funeral will be this, and then they're saying, we can't do this. Like, we actually can't accept the body because we can't cover the costs. So those are most of the bodies that are in those. We think there's 28, there was when I checked.
Yeah.
They move the bodies at night because obviously it's kind of upsetting, next to the kids' hospital to have these corpses in these freezer trucks. So the number may fluctuate, but there's somewhere between 2.5, 3.5 dozen bodies in there. And most of those are these cases. There's a few cases that the chief medical examiner has, but only four of them. Those are suspicious deaths. And there's nothing in the legislation to allow the government to say, okay, we're going to cremate those bodies. And so in that legal limbo, these cadavers stay frozen until somebody figures out what to do with them.
The cost of living crisis is such that, or the cost of burial or claiming these bodies is so high for people, they just can't afford to claim their loved ones.
There's two pressures. There's the general pressures of inflation that's making the cost of living so expensive for everything. And then there's the reality, you know, the funeral homes, they're a business, they're an industry, and fuel, wood, caskets, all the inputs for any kind of business, their prices have gone up. So, you know, rates have gone up. And if you ever had to deal with a funeral home as you get older and you end up dealing with funeral homes, you know, it doesn't take long before, you know, if you move away from a cremation to a religious service to a casket and a visitation, you know, you can be talking $10,000 in no time, right? So it's a problem.
What are officials saying? I mean, are there any subsidies or breaks that people can get so they can claim their loved ones?
So if you're receiving income support, there's a whole schedule of different prices. So, for example, the legislation will say for an adult or dependent 12 years of age or older, you can have $2,229. And then it kind of lists off the various options. But that might not cover all of the costs. And for people who aren't getting income support, so let's say they're people with modest income, so they're working, but the sort of people who, if you went to and said, hey, do you have $3,000 right now, or can you put $3,000 in your credit card? And the answer is no. We believe that that's the segment of society that's having the hardest time dealing with when a loved one dies and actually coming up with the money to pay. So we believe that it's their family members that they haven't claimed that are in those freezers, which for some people is very hard to accept because there's an assumption, I think, by many that, hey, if I can't do this, the government's going to take care, and there's going to be either some kind of mythical potter's field in their mind where there'll be a respectful kind of burial that will happen in a discreet, respectful location. Somebody will take care of it. So some of these people, and I've spoken to one who unfortunately won't do an interview, but for understandable reasons, that she was not, you know, she was shocked to think that the person that she did not claim might be one of the bodies in the freezers.
What is the government saying? Because, you know, there's only so many more containers that they can buy, only so much more space, right? So what is the government offering to do, if anything?
Yeah, but Neil, up until now, that's been the solution, right? Start off with one, now two, now three, now four, and there's one on standby, and there's more room there for others. But when we ask for reaction, and it's hard to tell if this was a plan or if it's a reaction to the fact that the information about what was in these freezers I don't think was ever supposed to come out, but in reaction to that, the relevant department, the Newfoundland Labrador Health Services, they said yesterday that, look, we're aware of the problem, and we do intend to, quote, in the coming months, build or start to build a permanent long-term storage facility. But whether that means in addition to the morgue or a whole new external facility, how many bodies will it take? And will that actually, you know, would it actually be big enough to accept and accommodate the number of bodies that we'll have? Because as I mentioned, this is the oldest province in Canada. The number of older people who are going to die is going to increase. And the number of single senior citizens who are women who are already sort of in a marginal income situation, the number of people who aren't going to be able to afford these funeral arrangements, that's going to increase. So will that be a solution, or is it just basically another giant freezer truck? That we don't know.
Anthony, thank you for your time.
Okay, Neil.
Anthony Germain is the host of On the Go, the CBC afternoon radio show in Newfoundland and Labrador. We reached him in St. John's. A Maine state commission says it's time to take another look at the use of controversial defoliants at a Canadian Forces base. After years of debate and study, the Canadian government acknowledged that two barrels of Agent Orange and Agent Purple were sprayed at New Brunswick's Canadian Forces base Gagetown in the 1960s. Payments were made to soldiers who could prove that they'd been exposed and had developed one of a list of associated illnesses. But Canadian Forces members who served at CFB Gagetown and U.S. service members who trained there in the years that followed have long contended that the exposure and the effects went well beyond the official story. And now a commission struck by the Maine state legislature has released a report calling the Canadian findings incorrect and biased. David Donovan was a member of that commission, and as a member of the U.S. National Guard, he was sent to CFB Gagetown for weeks of training. He has more recently been treated for two separate forms of cancer. We reached Mr. Donovan in Fort Fairfield, Maine.
Dave, when were you at CFB Gagetown?
I went down the first year that the Maine Army National Guard went down, and that was in 1971. I went there also in 72. And then again in the early 80s.
And how would you describe your exposure?
Well, we didn't realize that we were being exposed to deadly chemicals at the time. So there was no indication. Well, there was mysterious things going on that we were wondering about, like dead animals, animals that looked healthy, no damage to them, not in the trap. They were just gone, dead, you know, so we wondered about that. And of course, we also saw foliage that had died, but we didn't think anything of that, you know, probably sprayed with a herbicide or something like that. We made no connection between the problem in Vietnam, Agent Orange, and never suspected that Agent Orange would be something that we'd have to deal with.
When did you begin to think that you and your fellow service members had been put at risk?
I would say early 80s. I'd say probably early 80s that the deaths begin to mount up, that the connection seems to be the same. That's when the cancer toll took its toll. That's when we begin to lose. And now we're, like I say, we're up to 30 or 40%. That have passed on because of cancer, respiratory, other diseases associated with the Agent Orange problem from Vietnam.
That must have been hard to watch and hard to see, lose your friends.
Well, we still are. We're still losing them. Nothing has been done. And unfortunately, we are still sending troops over to Gagetown and Canadian forces are still training over there. Australia comes up and trains at Gagetown.
How certain can you be that those cancers were caused by the environment at CFB Gagetown?
Well, I just did an interview with the Portland, Maine Press Herald. Mm-hmm. And one thing that he asked me a little bit about how healthy I've tried to stay. Have I ever smoked? No, I never smoked. Have I ever drank alcohol? No, I never drank alcohol. Do I have a history of cancer in my family? No, I do not. So there is no signs, there's no indications that I also would have two bouts of cancer in the last 5 or 6 years. So it just seems to me that there's no way of proving it, no way of saying one way or the other. I know I was here for 12 summer camps, 2 weeks at a time. And I know many others have died And it is common knowledge. It is the same symptoms as our Vietnam guys.
A Canadian military spokesperson told our colleagues at CTV News that Canada's study, quote, concluded that aside from the two instances of testing in 1966 and 1967, all herbicides used at Base Gagetown were regulated and used in accordance with all federal and provincial regulations and scientific policies at the time. Given the comprehensive nature of this report, an additional inquiry is not planned at this time. Again, that's from a Canadian military spokesperson. You and your fellow commissioners want that to be reconsidered. What makes you insistent that it should be revisited?
We'd like to have that reconsidered because we heard testimony that dioxins collect in the fatty tissue. So part of that study was they tested fish coming into Gagetown, going out of Gagetown. But they peeled the flesh off the fish, the fatty tissue, the skin. They skinned the fish before they tested them. They took the fat off before they tested them. So therefore, they were not bad. So we would like to do a study, go back and research that by an independent concern. So there's a lot of things that took place, and our government is saying the same thing. They're telling us that there's no danger. They're telling us that we would have had to be there at the time that they sprayed, and they say that the problem goes away, the danger is gone.
So when you hear that kind of talk from military officials, Dave, how does it make you feel?
That's not said very well. That makes me very angry because I could be not talking to you right now, you know. I just got lucky. Many that had two cancers like I had are no longer with us. I mean, I've lost a lot of friends, so that makes me angry that they say that that we were not in danger. That it's devastating to hear.
Well, I'm glad you are doing okay, David, and I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Well, I thank you, Neil, very much, and you take care.
You too.
David Donovan was a member of the U.S. National Guard who trained at Canadian Forces Base Gagetown and a member of the State of Maine's Gagetown Harmful Chemical Study Commission. We reached him in Fort Fairfield, Maine. Chris Carley says the decision wasn't made lightly, but he's probably not regretting it right now. On Friday, Neil spoke with Mr. Carley, the co-owner of Holston's Diner in New Jersey, about choosing to auction off one of its booths, a booth that had a crucial supporting role in the final episode of The Sopranos, right before its famous abrupt ending. At the time, Mr. Carley said he had hoped to get a fairly modest sum for the booth, just some extra cash that would help cover renovation costs at the diner.
We put a minimum opening bid of $3,000 and, you know, hoping to get maybe 5 or 10 out of it just to help offset some costs within 24 hours. When I went to bed last night, we were at $57,000 and I was like, my mind was blown. I said, you know, we have 3 days, how far can this go?
As it turns out, it could go farther. In the end, the booth sold for more than $82,000 U.S. to an anonymous buyer. The winning bid includes the plaque that reserves the seats for the Soprano family. It does not include delivery. So the booth will no longer be there, but Chris Carley says its replacement will look more or less the same. And the end of the auction might see a bit of a return to normal at Holston's. Since news of the bidding got out, Mr. Carley told the New York Times, the diner has had as much attention as when that last episode first aired. Life moves fast. Sometimes it seems like all we're doing is rushing from one task to the next. And when we come to this stark realization about the way we're living, a lot of us try to pursue something completely different. We prioritize self-care, reading, napping, and baths in which we nap while reading. But that's not the approach that Samantha Gibson took when she embarked on a new leisure pursuit last year. In fact, she went in the opposite direction, and it has paid off, because later this month, the Chesterville, Ontario woman is heading to Texas, where she'll compete in the Elite Lady Bull Riders World Finals. We reached Samantha Gibson in Rochester, New York.
Samantha, you're in Rochester because you just wrapped up another bull riding competition. How'd it go?
I did. Yeah, it went well, actually. I made my ride, was successful, so I'm pretty happy with it.
Is it true you got hurt?
I did, yeah. Unfortunately, I actually ended up having a pretty significant injury to my hand this time around, but I had a really great medical team and I'm feeling quite better, so I'm pretty lucky.
You're going to be okay for upcoming competitions?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Where did you place?
So we are doing a point system for this one, so I got a point on the board, which is good.
That's good. So if we rewind to about a year ago, which is not that long ago, to take up a sport like this, or to take up any sport really, to be at the situation that you're in, why? Why did you choose bull riding?
That's really the million-dollar question. That seems to be what everyone wants to know these days. You know, I wanted to do something that I could reclaim my power as an individual. Sort of, I was in a kind of a place that I wasn't feeling really whole as a person. And I wasn't really, I felt very small and sort of broken down. And I wanted something where I could bounce back and take control of my life and really do something that I could say, you know, I did that, whether it ended up being something I did long term or just for the weekend. And, you know, bull riding seemed like the perfect prescription for, you know, people do that all the time, you know, skydiving or whatever it is that they choose to do, to be like, yeah, you know, I did that. I could do that.
You did it. That's for sure. You told the Ottawa Citizen, quote, "It was my crazy journey of feminine self-discovery," end quote. Were you watching, you know, something and you thought, because you could have picked boxing, you could have picked skydiving, you could have picked a lot of things. So what was that moment where the light bulb lit up?
Yeah, I used to ride horses for a while. So growing up, I was sort of had that animal experience, and I really enjoyed getting on horseback and being an equestrian. And it wasn't quite scratching the itch anymore. Like it wasn't quite enough to really strike that box for me, in a sense. And I was speaking to a friend of mine, sort of about this funk I was in and how I was trying to find something that was really, you know, it would really shake up my perspective and get me back on track with things. And he recommended bull riding, and it was something he had done in the past. And I was a little taken aback, but I figured, why not, right? Like, sure. So I did.
What were the first few rides like?
I wish I could tell you, but I definitely blacked out.
Because you fell, or you were just so nervous, or?
I think it was just nerves and adrenaline and like your heart's pumping and your mind is racing, and then it actually happens and you're riding and the next thing you know, you're on the ground, and kind of takes a little while to actually get some brain power going at the same time and get your thoughts cleared and slowed down enough to do any sort of skill or technique-based riding.
You were actually, if my memory serves me correctly, the second young woman I've spoken to who's taken up this sport and is competing and doing well, but it is still a very male-dominated sport. What has the reception been like?
Yeah, it is definitely... it's a man's world in roller riding, unfortunately, but we're trying to change that. You know, I've tried to be kind of a guiding light for women that want to get into it and younger girls that are interested and curious, and trying to put myself out there a bit to raise the awareness that it's a possibility and something that they can do. And the reception's been fantastic. In our area in Ontario, we have places that are really welcoming of women and really encouraging. It's been fantastic. And the guys are just as excited to see how far we can go with it as we are. So it's awesome.
More competition. What do your children think about all this?
They are sort of on the fence about it. I mean, they love animals. They're farm kids, so yeah. I don't know if they're quite young. So I'm not sure if they quite grasp the entirety of the sport, but they've seen videos of me riding and pictures, and they're really excited about it. I think down the line they'd might understand it a little bit more, and from what they've told me, they want to try it, but I'm hoping it's not something that they'll actually get into.
Well, I was going to ask but you that, because down the line they might want to, and how do you say no yeah. when it's been so great for you?
Exactly. I mean, I hope that they could do whatever they want to do in life, and I support them. I think as a parent, it's a little stressful to watch, though.
Understandable.
But yeah, they like it. I think they get really excited, and I try to bring them back a little souvenir from every country I go to. So they're a fan.
So you're set to compete at the Worlds in Texas later this month. Do you really want to win too, or is it just about that journey you mentioned and drawing people to the sport?
I think it's sort of a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, I really love doing it, and for me, it's not about the victory at the end of the day. It's not about the competition. The only person I'm competing with is myself, really, in my world. So it's sort of how well I can perform and how much I can achieve in my own sort of regard. But obviously, there's always that desire to win and do well, and you always want to come out on top regardless. Yeah. I mean, you work so hard for it. But I, you know, it's a win as a woman for us to even be having finals to begin with. So I'm pretty excited for it all around.
Do you feel nearly a year on now that it's given you what you were looking for all those months ago?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everything and more, I think. I wasn't expecting to find such a community and such a welcoming group of people, and everyone is really incredible and supportive, and it's a real privilege to be a part of it. So I'm really excited to continue doing it and keep pushing myself.
Samantha, thank you.
No problem. Thanks for speaking with me.
Samantha Gibson is a bull rider who will be competing in the World Championships in Texas later this month. We reached her in Rochester, New York. According to legend, blue cheese was invented in the 7th century when a shepherd hid his lunch of bread and cheese in a cave in order to run away from some bandits. When he ran back later, the bread and cheese were riddled with mold. But he was hungry from all the running, I guess, so he ate it, and it was great. And so a salad dressing was born. So the shepherd just left his sheep alone with bandits long enough for cheese to get moldy, and he hid the cheese in a cave because he couldn't run while carrying cheese. And when he got back, it was all mottled and pungent, but he ate it anyway, which, if it had killed him, would have left his sheep entirely alone. A strange guy and a terrible shepherd. Still, we should thank him for all our past blue cheeses. And now we should thank Tatiana Giraud and her colleagues at Paris-Saclay University for all the blue cheeses to come. The fungus that makes blue cheese, Penicillium roqueforti, mostly reproduces asexually, so it is susceptible to harmful mutations which weaken it, and if some kind of parasite or virus attacks it, it might break the mold, if you will, leaving us in a world without blue cheese. That's why Ms. Giraud and her team have made 5 new varieties of the fungus. Thrilling, robust new varieties that will secure the future of blue cheeses in case the foundation of the old blue cheese crumbles, like blue cheese. And these new strains can be combined to make whole new blue cheese styles. So we're going to be okay, everyone. If, you know, only in the context of blue cheese. And all because of a team of bold adventurers who went stilton at windmills. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.